Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Militiamen occupied towns and villages across East Timor today, and police evacuated dozens of UN staff workers from one of the many areas that were under siege by the marauding gangs. A new wave of violence also swept across parts of Dili, where votes are being counted in Monday's historic referendum on East Timor's future. Smoke poured from some shacks that had been set on fire near the UN compound in Dili's Bakura district. The UN mission said it was defenseless in the face of the deteriorating security situation and the inability of Indonesian defense forces to restore law and order. We'll have a report from Dili in just a little while. A delegation of U.S. congressional staffers shook hands with emaciated Iraqi children during a tour of Basra, Iraq's second largest city, as the delegates wrapped up their tour of the nation's battered south. The congressional group on a week-long humanitarian fact-finding mission arrived in Iraq on Saturday despite fierce opposition from the U.S. State Department, which claimed the trip would be used for propaganda by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. The group first toured Baghdad, the capital, and then were taken by authorities on a trip of Iraq south. In the southern port city of Basra, where 1.5 million people live, Iraqi doctors told the staffers that every 2 in 10 children born in southern Iraq suffer from some deformity. A Texas congressman and some rice farmers are asking for the easing of some trade sanctions against Cuba. They're visiting the nation in search of new markets. They're asking the U.S. lift restrictions on food and medicine sales to Cuba. Congressmember Nick Lamson is one of a series of lawmakers making visits to Cuba, underscoring the growing support for new ways to help hard-hit American farmers. Lamson says trade sanctions hurt American farmers as well as the Cuban people. More positive signs from the Mideast. Egypt's official Middle East news agency quotes Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat as saying an agreement has been concluded with the Israelis on all points. Earlier, a senior Israeli official said the Israelis and Palestinians had resolved their differences over the release of Palestinian prisoners. That had been a key sticking point recently in talks aimed at reviving the long-stalled Y River peace agreement. An official says the Palestinians ended up accepting an Israeli offer to release 350 Palestinians held for anti-Israeli activities. The star witness in the slaying of a West African immigrant may not be called to testify when the death penalty trial begins for the white supremacist charged in the killing. This news from Denver. Nathan Thill, 21, is accused of murdering Umar Dia because he was black and of paralyzing Jeannie Van Valkenburg, who tried to come to Dia's aid in a late-night attack in a downtown Denver bus stop. Ms. Van Valkenburg's testimony helped convict Thill's companion, Jeremiah Barnum, but Barnum was later granted a new trial because a judge ruled Van Valkenburg's emotional behavior, which included screaming, crying, and belching, jeopardized Barnum's right to a fair trial. A native of Senegal, the slightly statured Dia was a hotel bellhop, sending his earnings home to support his family and fellow villagers. Both Thill and Barnum, who worked at a service station, allegedly had ties to the skinhead movement. This news from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. It's been nearly 3 months since 2 Sioux men were found slain in a culvert near the Nebraska line, and many Indians doubt authorities even care whether they solve the crime. In fact, some Indian activists say the apparent standstill in the investigation only confirms their suspicion that white Nebraska lawmen helped kill Wilson Black Elk Jr. and Ronald Hardheart, or help cover up the crime to make it seem as if Indians were responsible. The deaths have led to a violent protest and heightened longstanding tensions between whites and the Oglala Sioux from the poor and desolate Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And finally, from the Amazon to the Atlantic in the mountains of Rio de Janeiro and the Pantano wetlands, Brazil is burning. Months of little or no rain have left most of the country tinder dry, and fires often deliberately set are raging out of control in forests and national parks across Latin America's largest country. Satellite images identified more than 31,000 fires in 15 states last month, according to Brazil's Environmental Protection Agency. But because the satellites from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration can't see through clouds or thick smoke, the total almost surely was higher, and September looks even worse. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here, joined with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners on this, the beginning of the last weekend of summer. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening, and along with millions of other Americans, are going to be getting this ready this weekend for school next week and getting their kids prepared. And, of course, along with that will come all the ongoing battles in public education around things like charter schools and vouchers and new standards and what it all means. Is it really dismantling of the public education system, or is it just a quest for better quality in our schools?
In fact, in Detroit right now, there is a major teacher strike that has, though, the support of the whole community, despite obviously the inconvenience of that. Teachers striking, among other issues, for smaller class size.
Yes, which is the single most important reform that would raise the level of education everywhere.
Well, we're going to turn right now to an issue that has been long simmering, and new information has come out on it in the last few days. U.S. Marshals this week seized tape evidence from the FBI showing that its agents got permission to use flammable tear gas canisters during the 1993 assault on the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. The marshals were sent to FBI offices by Attorney General Janet Reno, who was angry that the agency held on to the tapes for 4 days without turning over the evidence. The discovery of the audio tape is a second time in recent days the FBI has disclosed evidence of the use of the flammable military tear gas rounds after 6 years of adamantly denying that the devices had been used. Justice Department officials described Attorney General Janet Reno as furious with the discovery of the tape, which includes the voice of an FBI field commander authorizing his agents to fire pyrotechnic tear gas canisters into a concrete bunker at the compound. The commander, Richard Rogers, later sat behind then-FBI Director William Sessions when he testified before Congress and denied the use of such munitions. Several hours after the munitions were fired, a fire at the compound killed 80 members of the group, including its leader, David Koresh. The Justice Department and the FBI continued to maintain that Koresh and his followers started the fire. Well, controversy over Waco, one of the murkiest incidents in recent American history, was reignited last week when the Dallas Morning News uncovered evidence from a Texas lawsuit that FBI agents had used the incendiary canisters and quoted a former senior FBI official who confirmed the story. The paper also quoted a former CIA officer as saying that three or four commandos of the Delta Force, a secret Army unit, had played an active role in helping the FBI in the final assault of the compound. The Pentagon has said that members of the unit were there only as observers. Lee Hancock is with us now. She is the Dallas Morning News reporter who broke the story. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lee.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us exactly what you found out?
Well, several things. One, there was a photograph taken at the crime scene that depicted one of these devices. It's called an M651 CS tear gas grenade. There was also a shell casing that was recovered. Now, what's interesting is the projectile itself that was photographed has disappeared from the evidence lockers, which are in the custody of the Texas Rangers. This is an arm of the Texas Department of Public Safety. They were brought in to help investigate. And we discovered that the FBI had acknowledged years ago, back in 1993, when the shell casing was found, they acknowledged to the Texas Rangers that, yes, that this was theirs and they had had permission to fire it. Additionally, after the fire itself, there are documents in the Justice Department that have surfaced that indicate that hostage rescue team members had acknowledged firing military rounds. Records surfaced from civil attorneys in the Justice Department who are defending a wrongful death suit that's been filed by the Davidians. They became curious enough, apparently, about or concerned enough about allegations being raised by plaintiff's lawyers in that case that in 1996 they went to the FBI and said, "We would like for clarification from you on what might be going on here." They brought, and among other things, my understanding is this photograph of this device. The hostage rescue team was questioned, and there is a memo in the file of the FBI General Counsel's office in which it's written that these hostage rescue team members absolutely acknowledged that they had fired two of these devices. Now, the key issue is, did people understand that these military devices, military gas rounds, were in fact pyrotechnic? There's a great insistence that no one understood that military gas rounds meant that this was something capable of starting a fire. But United States military CS tear gas rounds are universally pyrotechnic in nature.
Now, in terms of how significant this is, because the allegations are that the canisters were used against a concrete bunker, not against the actual dwelling in which the Branch Davidians were in. How significant is this?
Well, the FBI has argued that these things were used at about 7:42, 7:43 in the morning. The fire itself did not break out until noon. So there's several issues. One, you have people, in all walks, looking at this, not just folks who have been talked about as militia or right wing or, anti-government folks, but even people like this gentleman, Henry Ruth. He's a former Watergate prosecutor. He helped head the United States Treasury review of the actions of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. In Waco, they are the agency that started the siege with a raid on February 28th. Mr. Ruth also headed an independent investigation into the MOVE tragedy where the row houses in Philadelphia were set afire. And Mr. Ruth yesterday told me that if there are two, you have to wonder whether there are four or more. He noted that by 11 o'clock, the FBI was extraordinarily frustrated. These people were not coming out. And he said that, there has to be a hard look at what else might have been used. Others that are looking at this, people within Congress, even people who have been traditionally supporters of the FBI and its actions in Waco, have said this just simply makes people question everything the FBI says. It makes people question what else might be out there that hasn't been recovered yet.
Lee Hancock of the Dallas Morning News. We're also joined by David Hardy, an attorney in Arizona, who for the past 3 years has been battling government agencies through the courts to gain access to records on the standoff. He's filed 8 Freedom of Information Act requests with the Justice Department and the FBI and recently won $32,000 in attorney's fees after a judge ruled that the FBI and the Agency for Tobacco and Firearms had stonewalled his requests. David Hardy, how significant do you think this latest information, this actual audio tape of the FBI field commander telling the other FBI agents to use the incendiary devices is?
It can be quite important. I would agree with Mr. Ruth that the two objects that were found are not themselves, that important. They were fired hours before the fire and at some distance. But the thing is, we have had the government position has been throughout that it never used any of them. That's what it told the Attorney General. That's what it told everyone else. And now suddenly we discovered that, okay, we did use a few of them. And you've got to start asking the question, did you use any later in the day? Did you use any against the building itself? I think they did. Some of the surviving Davidians have testified that their phrase was something effective. They could hear the tear gas rounds hissing under the furniture, and they were too hot to pick up and throw out. That is a description of a pyrotechnic round, not the non-pyrotechnic ferrets that the FBI claimed it was using. A pyrotechnic round burns a gunpowder mixture, expels the tear gas as part of its smoke. It also expels fire, and it takes about 30 seconds to shoot off its load. So for 30 seconds, it's hissing, and they're specifically designed to get too hot to pick up to prevent you from picking them up and throwing them out during this time. That suggests to me that these rounds were fired into the building itself, which can have a link to the fire.
Well, Lee Hancock, in terms of the credibility of the FBI, a couple of years ago we had the enormous scandal over the FBI laboratory and Frederick Whitehurst, the whistleblower who went through so much persecution within the FBI. And now we had the situation of the Attorney General actually ordering U.S. Marshals to seize records. And the New York Times today is reporting a growing rift between FBI Director Free and Janet Reno. What is this doing to the reputation, the credibility of the FBI across the country?
I think it has damaged it. I think that people within the Bureau acknowledge that they have had a very embarrassing couple of weeks. And line agents, guys in the field, feel like there is some concern that they will be affected by this. I talked to the United States Attorney in San Antonio, and he oversees the Waco Federal Prosecutor's Office, and he said that he's concerned that it's not just the FBI agents, but all federal agents are going to feel some impact. He said that they have cases in trial. They have juries that are being selected. They have people who are private citizens who are being asked to pass on the honesty and the evidence of the federal government, not just brought by the FBI. And he said that they're going to have great problems with that for some time. They say that it's a blow not just for the FBI, but for all of federal law enforcement. But certainly I think the FBI is going to be deeply affected for some time.
David Hardy, what does this mean for the movement and the militia movement in this country that have certainly been saying that federal agents were responsible for the deaths of the Branch Davidians who died in the Waco Inferno? How does this fuel that movement?
Well, in the short term, it would probably help it because, you know, there would be some people who've been concerned over this who would now feel vindicated, that their fears have been vindicated. In the long run, if they do the right thing and have an impartial outside assessment of the evidence that, in fact, gets to the bottom of things, it might, in the long run, undercut a sort of militia movement simply because those type of movements thrive on the idea that there is no alternative, to use the 60s jargon, there is no alternative within the system. And if you can demonstrate that the system works, there tends to be less of a need for that sort of thing. So short-term, beneficial to that sort of movement. Long-term, maybe not, if they handle it correctly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, the latest news we have that Attorney General Janet Reno has narrowed down the list of candidates for an independent investigator, an independent counsel prosecutor in this case, investigating the FBI. Our guests have been David Hardy, attorney in Arizona, who for years has been battling government agencies to get information on what happened at Waco, and Lee Hancock, who has broken this story. She's from the Dallas Morning News. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we head to Dili, East Timor, to find out about the mounting violence there. In just hours, the UN is expected to announce the results of the historic referendum in East Timor that took place on Monday. We'll also speak with Noam Chomsky about why Americans should care about what's happening in East Timor. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to East Timor, bracing for more violence today from militias armed and backed by Indonesia. With an announcement due tomorrow of the result of this past Monday's referendum on independence, the result is expected to show overwhelming support for self-determination for the people of East Timor for independence in the island. The militias have effectively taken control of a number of areas in East Timor, the towns of Maliana in western East Timor and Lakisa, where a terrible massacre took place in April, participating in that militias as well as Indonesian military. Also, Ermera, which is just a few miles south of the capital, Dili, where they're operating with impunity. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, is expressing concern over the violence perpetrated by the death squads, which have so far killed scores of civilians. Robinson's talking about a substantial UN peacekeeping force may be needed to protect, quote, the fundamental human rights of a terrorized population. Before we turn to Noam Chomsky about why Americans should care, just before the show, I reached Dili, East Timor, journalist Alan Nairn, to talk about the situation in Dili.
Well, I think it's normal. I think it's normal for Timor for, you know, most of the years of the occupation. In a sense, I think the international coverage I've seen is, in a way, exaggerated. In another way, not. I think it's exaggerated in the sense that it's not as if what's happening now is unusual for Timor. This is what the Timorese have been living with since 1975. Today was actually the first day that I got the feeling that the terror, in this case in Dili, had returned to the levels that existed, say, prior to the Dili massacre. The actual death toll around Dili has been higher than that time, but the feeling of all pervasive danger of death possibly being around every corner, that really wasn't there until today. But today, talking and that was always there, in 1990-91. But today, every Timorese you heard about was fleeing their home, running up to the hills, because the militias, the army-backed militias just in Dili have been sacking and burning homes in the Bakora neighborhood, in the Comoro neighborhood. They've reportedly burned 200 houses, at least, in Maliana. The death toll of Timorese UN workers killed is now acknowledged to be 4, and 6 are missing. In the past 2 days, there have been telephoned threats to the UN civil police that the militias might raid the Dili Museum, where the referendum votes are being counted, and burn the ballots. Many Timorese tonight are sheltering in the homes of friends. It is a frightening situation for the Timorese, but in a way it's not an exception. I mean, this is what it's like in an occupied country where they've killed a third of the population. I only wish all these international reporters who are now getting all excited and who are now chartering planes to get the hell out of Dili, I wish they'd been here in 75 and 85 and 1991. If half of these reporters had been there at the Dili massacre, with their cameras running and immediate coverage, this nightmare could have ended a long time ago. In a way, it's kind of welcome to reality for all these reporters and international observers. This is the reality the Timorese have been living with, people in a number of countries, a number of, U.S.-backed military terror countries have been living in these kind of conditions. And, that's what's happening in Dili today. I think if, as many people are saying today, it really does happen that all these UN people pull back from the field to Dili, many of the civilian non-governmental organization monitors pull back from the field to Dili, and in fact leave Timor because many have to get back to school or to work in America and Europe and elsewhere. If many of the journalists who are now in the Hotel Turismo and in the Makota, if they get on the charters and hop out of Timor, I think that'll be very bad because it will really take away the screen of international presence that has transformed the atmosphere in Timor. I mean, it's been so different here with all these foreigners around. It really has provided a measure of protection for the Timorese, as bad as things have been. And now if they all run away, it's going to be very rough for the Timorese. I also, it really occurs to me that, you know, noting these four UN Timorese employees killed, six missing, imagine if those had been American UN employees or Americans of any kind or, you know, British people. I think the international reaction would have been a lot different. I don't think, as of this morning, Clinton would have been able to still pump, you know, money and military supplies into the Jakarta regime. But because they're just Timorese UN employees, that support for Jakarta can continue, even though there's apparently no shortage of finger-wagging and empty words coming out of Washington and the Western powers. I mean, it's outrageous. Clinton can stop this right now, and he's not doing it. It's on him.
What do you make of Assistant Secretary of State Stanley Roth telling the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that Indonesia is capable of disbanding the militias and must face international intervention if it fails to do so? That's something the U.S. ambassador, the British ambassador to the UN, when I spoke to them in the last few days, were not even willing to say that the Indonesian military is responsible for these militias. We're getting the sense that the militias are now out of everyone's control.
Well, they're not. I mean, the militias are tightly controlled by the Indonesian Army Special Forces. It's actually been, if you look at it, a pretty finely calibrated operation, as one Western military person put it to me here the other day. This is a brinksmanship operation. Wiranto takes, with the militias, takes things up to the brink, sees how much they can get away with without paying a concrete price, and then they pull back a little. I don't think these militias are in any way out of control. I think they're very... they're on a very tight leash from Jakarta and TNI headquarters, and it's definitely true that Jakarta can shut them down. To talk about international intervention, though, really confuses things. Intervention isn't the right word when the problem is that international powers are feeding the beast, are feeding the TNI ABRI, the Indonesian army. Just stop feeding it. To stop backing it. They'll be terrified. That army is very dependent politically in many other ways on their international sponsors. And as soon as they know that the sponsors are seriously going to cut aid, they'll stop. But they will not stop until that moment. It doesn't require intervention, sending in troops. It's not as if the U.S. and the other powers are third parties looking on at atrocities committed by some perpetrator they have nothing to do with. They're the quartermaster for the perpetrator. They're the paymaster. They're the people who make that army killing machine run. They've just got to stop supplying the fuel. That's the way to stop.
Alan Nairn speaking to us from Dili, East Timor. And joining us on the line now from Massachusetts is Professor Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, who has written extensively about East Timor since the Indonesian military invaded in 1975. Since that time, in this last quarter of a century, responsible for the deaths of a third of the Timorese population, 200,000 Timorese. And we see that that killing continues. Noam Chomsky has just written a piece for the Mother Jones online East Timor section called Why Americans Should Care About East Timor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Noam. Well, you've just heard Alan describing the situation in East Timor. Does anything surprise you about what he has said?
Afraid not. I think he's exactly accurate, as he's been for many years on this and other topics. That's exactly what's going on, and his crucial points, I think, are very well taken. The issue is not intervention. The issue is turning off the tap. The U.S. knows exactly how to do it. The U.S. supported Indonesia passionately through the period of its worst atrocities internally, its invasion of East Timor, while Suharto is compiling an outrageous human rights record at home. When the U.S. got tired of him, he finally did some things that the U.S. didn't like, namely two things. In the fall of 1997, one, he made his first two mistakes. He lost control, and that's no good. No use having your favorite dictator if he can't control the population. And even worse, he was dragging his feet on IMF proposals, which would have, in effect, destroyed the Indonesian economy, and he wasn't implementing them properly. Those were the two errors. The IMF flew in and ordered him in a very dramatic moment to sign up. In fact, there was a picture circulated all over Indonesia with Suharto sitting at a desk signing a statement while the director, Michel Kamdissou, of the IMF was standing above him with his arms crossed in what the press described as a typical colonial stance. Shortly after, in May 1998, Secretary of State Albright informed Suharto that the time had come for him to resign and provide for what he called a democratic transition. A couple hours later, that's exactly what he did. The U.S., it's not just cause and effect, but the U.S. understands very well how to terminate all of this. They don't need any instructions, and they don't want to do it. That's the most important point that Alan made. I mean, in much of this discussion about intervention and the last couple of months, there has been a really cowardly evasion, and we should avoid it. The evasion is to say, well, yeah, we're inconsistent, we have a double standard, sometimes we look the other way, but at least let's do the right thing sometimes. That's not the point. The U.S. government is not looking away. The British government is not looking away. Neither in this case nor many other cases, many of them comparable or worse, Turkey, for example, right now, Colombia, it doesn't look away. It participates actively to escalate atrocities and violence. It's not looking away. In East Timor is a dramatic case because it's been going on for 25 years now. What's looking away has been the media and intellectual opinion, apart from a few people like you and Alan. It's direct involvement. The U.S. Has an overwhelming control. It's not necessary to bomb Jakarta. It's not even necessary to have sanctions. It is simply necessary to inform the Indonesian military that this game is over, just the way they informed Suharto in May 1998 his game was over and it was time for him to move into the background.
Well, Noam Chomsky, this is Juan Gonzalez here. I just wanted to ask you, several years ago, I recall when Amy and Alan returned from surviving that massacre in Dili, I wrote a column for the Daily News about it, and the reaction of my editor at first was, East Timor, whoever heard of that? Why should we care about it? I proceeded to try to explain to him. I'm amazed that a major editor at a Metropolitan Daily newspaper did not even know where East Timor was. What about this ability, this continued ability of the mass media in our country to totally ignore major human rights situations that are occurring around the world just because the U.S. government doesn't want to shed any attention on them, as you mentioned, what's going on in Turkey or Colombia? And why should the American people care about these situations?
Well, the American people do care, and that's why the media keep it quiet. They know perfectly well that if the population knows about it, they're not going to like it. The American population will not easily accept the fact that they are contributing through their taxes and their tacit support to huge massacres. For example, let's take, say, Turkey. If the U.S. population knew that within NATO itself, not outside its borders, there was ethnic cleansing and atrocities and massacres going on on a scale way beyond what was attributed to Milosevic in Kosovo, and that they were paying for it, and that the arms were increasing, thanks to Clinton, as the atrocities were increasing, you would have seen a public reaction, and that's why there's no reporting. Not that you don't know. I mean, you can easily find out. After all, these atrocities are going on in an area where there are U.S. air bases all over the place, including nuclear-armed planes. It's just not... And, in fact, there are a few reporters reporting, like Jonathan Randall, who's a veteran Middle East correspondent of the Washington Post. I think he resigned a couple of years ago. But he's been there for years and has just written an excellent book about it. That's not the story. The story that comes from Washington is concentrate on some particular enemy's crimes, and then you fly in and concentrate on their crimes, and you demonstrate, you know, you show great concern for all the awful things they're doing and so on. Now, look, you saw this in Haiti. The orders come from on top, and that's where you go. Now, there are exceptions. It's pretty standard, and the East Timor is a dramatic case because it's been going on for 25 years. In fact, the coverage declined to actually zero in the national press as the atrocities mounted. The 200,000 killed figure, which is now widely accepted, that's a figure which was presented by very credible sources, church sources and others, back in 1978, at the time when the Carter administration was rushing new arms to Indonesia, and the atrocities were peaking with massive assaults, bombing, napalm, so on up in the mountains. It was not the right topic. We were supposed to worry about something else at that time, somebody else's crimes. Current situation, as Alan pointed out quite rightly, I mean, it may look new to reporters, but that's because they weren't there before. If it's a continuation, it's not anywhere near the peak of atrocities. A couple of months ago, it was worse than it is now. Amy mentioned that the militia, meaning the Indonesian paramilitaries, have taken over Liquisa. Well, you know, that was a town where just back in April, people were fleeing from the Indonesian-run paramilitaries. They fled into a church. About 60 were massacred in the church. Most of the rest were taken out and turned into effectively slave labor up in the mountains. A lot of the town was burned down. This is going on in April. It was widely reported in the press, namely the Australian press. There was no reason not to report it here.
Noam, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'd like to ask if you could stay for just three more minutes after that break. We're speaking with Noam Chomsky, who has written a piece most recently for the Mojo Wire, which is at www.motherjones.com, which is reporting extensively on East Timor right now, called Why Americans Should Care About East Timor. And we've just been listening to a report from journalist Alan Nairn in Dili, East Timor. By the way, I should mention that Alan is on the Army blacklist. He was able to secretly get into Indonesia 4 months ago. When I was deported last week, I saw his name on that blacklist, the red-bound book that has more than 1,000 names. Alan, who survived the massacre of 1991, where more than 250 Timorese were killed by the Indonesian military arm with U.S. weapons. In 94, we returned to cover Clinton going to Jakarta. He met with Suharto, as well as his own campaign contributors. When we tried to get into East Timor then, we were arrested by the Indonesian military, though we eventually did get in. Alan went back last year, held a news conference in Jakarta, where he revealed documents that showed, once again, the United States military training Kopassus troops, the crack Indonesian military troops, in torture techniques and terrorism. And Alan was then deported from Indonesia and now has returned, has been there for about 4 months and got into Dili as well, despite that blacklist. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Noam Chomsky in a minute.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician
bent
enough
to bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest Noam Chomsky, professor at MIT, well-known critic of U.S. policy in many areas, the Middle East, as well as Indonesia, Turkey, has written this piece called Why Americans Should Care About East Timor. It's interesting, Noam, to look at the coverage. Now, there is more coverage, although it almost never talks about the U.S. support for the Indonesian military and its occupation of East Timor. But we did see a change recently, not so much in tone, because Seth Meidens of The New York Times on Monday had a piece where he talked about the Timorese playing victim. It was quite astounding how he put it, as he talked about after 24 years of war and propaganda, they know how to play the well-intentioned victim. And I could only think about right now how, well, the latest report from The Washington Post, about 100 people, including 25 journalists, being evacuated from Dili this morning, a British Broadcasting Corporation reporter beaten and kicked. When the reporters get not even a tenth of the treatment that the Timorese get, they get out.
That was an amazing comment. I saw that. But in fact, I think his general reporting is, the tone of it is pretty shocking. I mean, this morning, the pro-independence thugs and the anti-independence ruffians, as if it's some kind, that's the conflict that's going on. The same is true in other newspapers. For example, this morning's Boston Globe, where I am, the report, by not a bad reporter, talks about how the problem has been that since the Indonesian invasion, there has been a civil war and starvation. There hasn't been any civil war since the Indonesian invasion. There was a civil war for a couple of weeks before the Indonesian invasion. That was long over before Indonesia invaded. But that's kind of a more acceptable way to describe it. And as you say, nothing or virtually nothing about the fact that it's been a decisive U.S. contribution all along. The standard line has been, well, you know, Washington Post, James Fallows, others, maybe we looked away too long and we should have become involved, but we were busy with other things. Or as the Wall Street Journal put it, we were overwhelmed by the tragedy of, our tragedy, of course, in Vietnam. Not the tragedy of millions of Vietnamese who were killed. But we didn't look away. You know, maybe the population didn't know, but the press knew, the government knew, and directly involved themselves in escalating the massacre. And in fact, they were pretty frank about it. Daniel Moynihan, who was the UN ambassador, boasted in his memoirs 20 years ago that he had rendered the UN utterly ineffective in anything it might do, because the State Department wanted things to turn out as they did. You could hardly find a more straight comment from right on top. It made no ripples.
But the change now in the New York Times, which is interesting, is that for years many people have been criticizing them for talking about, when they rarely reported on Indonesia, on East Timor. The dateline is Dili, Indonesia, as opposed to Dili, East Timor, but now it's changed.
Actually, the Boston Globe just changed it about 3 days ago. Up until then, it was Dili, Indonesia. But look, the Timorese are still called a separatist movement. I mean, what makes them a separatist movement? I mean, were the Kuwaitis a separatist movement after Iraq invaded? The framing of the issue, and the complete evasion of responsibility, direct crucial responsibility, those are striking, and they have to be overcome if we want to do anything constructive about this. To get back to Alan's point, which I think ought to be stressed, there is no need for punitive action against Jakarta. there is a need for the Clinton administration to tell them this game is over.
What is your sense, though, if the Clinton administration does not do that, of what may develop in East Timor over the next few weeks?
Well, I think Alan's prognosis is very realistic. The kind of continuing terror of the Indonesian-run paramilitaries is very likely to drive out all the Westerners. The reporters will pull out, except for a courageous few. They'll be taken out. The Indonesians will keep others out. The UN mission, not even allowed to carry sidearms, they're going to go out because it's too dangerous for them. And you get back to a closed territory where the Indonesia and its paramilitary terrorists can do as they please. They've already said what they're going to do. I mean, maybe they won't, but they've said that they're going to turn it into the commander of the military in Dili just a couple of weeks ago told the Australian national television that, I'll quote him, "I would like to convey the following. If the pro-independents do win, all will be destroyed, and East Timor won't be as we see it now. It will be worse than 23 years ago." Well, you know, we can disregard what the commander said a couple of weeks ago if we like. But it's that could happen. And it's more likely to happen as attention shifts away. It's just the focus of attention that prevents it from happening. When the attention was withdrawn 20 years ago, that's exactly what happened then, with a huge slaughter and starvation, you know, comparable or worse than Cambodia or Biafra. And it could happen again.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Noam, for joining us today. And we want to let people know, again, there are things, as people could always do, and we've seen tremendous change actually happen around the issue of East Timor because of the activism in this country. As Alan has always said, people do all they can in East Timor. It is really up to us. But just President Clinton making it very clear that the violence must stop would make that difference. And if people want to call the president, remember his number, it is 202-456-1414. That is 202-456-1414. In addition to the Mother Jones website, www.motherjones.com, where you can get the latest on East Timor, you can always go to our website, www.pacifica.org. You can listen to the conversations we've been having with Alan Daly in Dili, East Timor, and the ETAN website, East Timor Action Network, that lets you know about the legislation that's up before Congress, like Bill 1063 in the House, that would cut off all loopholes to military training of Indonesian soldiers. Again, Noam Chomsky, thanks for being with us, speaking to us from Massachusetts. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to our last segment, which has to do with our continuing coverage of the Puerto Rican prisoners. Juan, just 2 weeks ago, came back from Puerto Rico, where two issues are dominating the news headlines and people's consciousness. One is the continued U.S. naval bombing of Vieques. The other, the prisoners that are being held in U.S. jails around the country. Well, it's not just Puerto Ricans on the island that care about this issue or are focusing on it. Congressional Republicans this week are also looking into it and have stepped up pressure on the Clinton administration to withdraw the clemency offer it made last month to several Puerto Rican political prisoners and activists, subpoenaing White House and Justice Department records and raising the likelihood of congressional hearings on the matter in the fall. Congressmember Dan Burton, the Republican of Indiana, is spearheading the effort. He's the head of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. He's also the one who has subpoenaed Attorney General Janet Reno and White House Counsel Cheryl Mills. Clinton has offered conditional clemency to some members of the Puerto Rican Independence Group, the Armed Forces of National Liberation, known as the FALN, if they agree to renounce violence, refrain from meeting with other independence leaders, and obey stringent guidelines barring them from using weapons. Under the proposal, 11 of the 16 prisoners would be eligible immediately for release. Two would have to serve more time before they're freed. Three, who've already been released from prison, would have fines against them reduced. The activists who were never ever connected to an act of murder or violence and who have already served 14 to 19 years in prison are still reviewing the proposal. We're joined on the telephone now by Michael Deutsch, one of their attorneys, as their other attorney, Jan Slusser, goes from prison to prison speaking with the prisoners directly. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Thank you.
Can you summarize for us these latest developments? It looks like when the House comes back into session next week, this may be the issue that dominates their first actions.
Yeah, it looks a very dangerous situation, and it's really essentially being fanned. These flames are being fanned by the FBI and other law enforcement working with these right-wing Republicans. What we have seen since President Clinton granted the clemency is really a disinformation campaign kind of akin to COINTELPRO that the FBI began in 1960, directed against the prisoners, putting out that they're violent, that they're committed to continuing with violence, and trying to undermine the exercise of the president's presidential prerogative of clemency. And it's even got to the point where they're putting information that there are secret tapes that the Bureau of Prisons have, where the prisoners are talking about resuming violence upon their release from prison, which has turned out to be totally false. The Bureau of Prisons says they know of no such tapes. No such tapes exist. The FBI has put out a press release, which is unsigned and anonymous, saying that the prisoners have no remorse and they'll continue with their violent ways. So we have a climate that is really being created by law enforcement, which is very dangerous, and it's kind of a two different worlds. In Puerto Rico, you have tens of thousands of people marching in the streets calling for unconditional release. You have the Catholic Archbishop saying that the teachings of Catholicism demand unconditional release for all the prisoners. You have all the political groups, religious groups, all supporting it. And in the U.S., you have this, you know, this right-wing surge saying they should withdraw the clemency. So we are in a very difficult period and a very difficult situation, and it really underscores what our point has been. If our clients come out under this parole-type conditions, which is conditional release, given the climate of the law enforcement, particularly in Chicago and New York, they can be sent back to prison and lose their clemency and have to do the rest of their time on a violation, without a trial, without a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, without real due process. The FBI could easily set them up. They could put drugs in their house, their car. They could set them up with a gun. They could violate them for merely associating with other people who have criminal records in the independence movement. And we know since the independence movement has been criminalized over the last three, four decades, there are many of the leaders, many of the activists, Lolita LeBron, Rafael Cancel Miranda, and others, who have criminal records. So if they met with them at a demonstration, they could be violated and sent back to prison and have to do the rest of their time. So it really underscores the problems with this conditional release and the limitations on their political freedom.
Well, Michael, I'd like to ask you, in terms of setting the record straight on some of this misinformation that has come out, obviously one that we've heard a lot of in the last few days, and I have to say every time I turn on the TV, one of these talk shows, there's a debate or a battle going on over this issue. You had Dick Morris in the New York Post, who has no credibility but manages to still write a column, talking about how this clemency of President Clinton will become the Willie Horton case for Hillary Clinton and her Senate run. The facts on this issue of renouncing violence. Now, I know because I had gotten the information from Jan Susler months ago that back 2.5 years ago, the prisoners sent out a collective message indicating that they were perfectly willing, if the United States began this decolonization process of Puerto Rico, to join a democratic process, and were actually somewhat self-critical of what had happened in the past. And then recently they issued an even more clear declaration that they have no intention of getting involved in violent activities in the fight for Puerto Rican independence. Yet this whole issue of they haven't renounced violence continues to be raised.
Yeah, I mean they've each individually have unequivocally said they're committed to nonviolence upon their release. They said it 2 years ago. It was in a more of a context. But now each one of them has said that they're committed to nonviolence and they are not going to be involved in any acts of violence upon their release. The problem is that not many people want to hear that who are opposed to their release. In addition, because there are other conditions in this clemency, the conditions of release, and also that doesn't cover all the other prisoners, that we haven't really accepted it, and therefore people are saying, well, the fact that it hasn't been accepted means that they're still committed to violence. And that's really a distortion of the reality. The reality is that each one of them believes that for themselves, at this juncture, violence is not an option and is not appropriate.
Michael Deutsch, what about the Newsweek report saying they have one of them on tape saying that they will resume violence when they get out?
Well, that Newsweek report, and I've been in contact with the general counsel of Newsweek. First of all, that's an anonymous report that says secret tapes, Bureau of Prison secret tapes exist that have not been released yet. Doesn't say when the tapes were made or what exactly the tapes say. The White House itself called the acting director of the Bureau of Prisons, and he told them we have no such tapes and know of no such tapes. So again, it's COINTELPRO, again, putting out false information to discredit people who are active in the independence movement.
And
as far as we know, it would be absurd to think that they would be talking on the telephone, which they know is monitored, about intentions to go out and commit acts of violence, which they have unequivocally said they're not even don't even think politically for themselves it makes sense to do.
Well, and clearly the bigger issue is that most Americans don't want to deal with the fact that Puerto Rico remains the Irish question of American history. The FALN and the Macheteros were only the last of a long string of groups that have had to resort to violence to continue to raise the continuing colonial situation. Until that's dealt with, there will be new generations of this kind of activity in the future.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Michael Deutsch, for joining us, attorney for Puerto Rican prisoners that remain in jail. And Juan, thanks for your continued reporting on this issue. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Matthew Finch, our engineer today. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the show, 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Unequivocally said they're not even don't even think politically for themselves it makes sense to do.
Well, and clearly the bigger issue is that most Americans don't want to deal with the fact that Puerto Rico remains the Irish question of American history. The FALN and the Macheteros were only the last of a long string of groups that have had to resort to violence to continue to raise the continuing colonial situation. Until that's dealt with, there will be new generations of this kind of activity in the future.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Michael Deutsch, for joining us, attorney for the Puerto Rican prisoners that remain in jail. And Juan, thanks for your continued reporting on this issue. That does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Matthew Finch, our engineer today. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the show, 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!